So it's 2:30 Wednesday afternoon, April 22nd, and we're going to do the second part of the acetylsalicylic acid lab. As you guys are logging in and getting going, I'm going to apologize ahead of time because my wife and my daughter stepped out for the afternoon and left me with the two dogs. And whenever that happens, the two dogs are extraordinarily barky. So they are going to sound off periodically. And hopefully they're not going to be too much. And but when you hear them, now you kind of know what's going on. We're going to do the salicylic acid, second day on salicylic acid. And today is the characterization day. So we did the synthesis the other day. And basically what I'm going to do is back up a little bit, review kind of what we did. So let's hit our afternoon lecture from last Monday. And we'll just look at that last piece. This was our chemical reaction that we set up. So we ran this chemical reaction and we set up everything. We had the jack stand all set up, the hot plate, the sand bath. There goes my dogs. Hopefully they're not going to do that this whole time. I'm going to freak out myself. We heated this thing up to 50 degrees. We used 0.210 grams of salicylic acid. We added the acetic anhydride. We made sure that the amount of acetic anhydride that we had was the proper amount. Then we added the concentrated phosphoric acid, heated it for 8 to 10 minutes, let it cool to room temperature, added the 3 mL of water, filtered it. And then after we filtered it, we rinsed it on the Hirsch, we air dried it, we stored it in the Petri dish, we weighed the crystals, we labeled it, stored it in the locker, we come back today, and we do characterization. So today is the characterization day. And that's the first thing that I want to hit is that, I'm not back in a couple of minutes, I am now here, is that we are not so interested in how pure the material is, although we are interested in the purity of the material as well, but it's really about product characterization. That what we're interested in doing is we're interested in showing that the product is what we say it is. So anytime you do a synthesis or an isolation, anytime you get a new or novel product, the next step is figuring out, is that product what you say it is? And that's the process of characterization, of characterizing the product. And that can include a multitude of different types of tests to look at the product and to show that it is what you say it is. Purity is a different question. So we have purity, which is telling me about, is there any contaminants within the product? So this is sometimes given in a percent or a percent composition. So purity versus characterization. In the purity, we're asking how pure is it? Is it 100% of one material? And in the characterization, we're asking, what is the melting point? How does it do with chemical tests? What happens with spectroscopy? And there are many different types of spectroscopy, such that we could do nuclear magnetic resonance. We can do carbon, C13, and proton. We can do FTIR. We could do mass spec. And we could also do other types of spectroscopy or chromatography. We could do chromatography as well. So chromatography can also tell us if the material is what we think it is, perhaps like GC mass spec in combination together, can tell us and identify the material. But over here, purity, chromatography can also tell us if there are any other side products. And it can also tell us the amounts. So oftentimes, when we first start doing synthesis, students want to talk about the purity of a material and whether or not the material is of high purity or low purity. And that's what they get a little bit focused on. And instead, I'm not so focused on the purity. I'm much more focused on what the characterization is and characterizing the product. And can you demonstrate to me that the product is what you claim it to be? Because just because we do a transformation on a chemical doesn't mean that that transformation is successful. It doesn't mean that it comes out the way that we expect it to. And so the process of going through and characterizing is one of checking all of the physical properties of the molecule and some of the chemical properties and making sure that they are what we expect them to be. And then we also want that there to be alignment in our characterization, such that each phase of the characterization should be telling you the same thing. So if we do happen to have impurities, if there are side products present, is that reflected in my melting point, my chemical test, my spectroscopy, my chromatography? Is it reflected in all of those things? Or is the melting point, chemical test, spectroscopy, chromatography consistent with the material being all homogeneous and only one material? And do all of the tests agree with each other and show the same thing? And that's what we're going to be after. And that's what our process of writing up the results of this experiment is the process of writing up the results is taking a look at all of the characterization tests and analyzing each one, indicating what each one says. And if we happen to find that one of the characterization tests shows that it is not what it is supposed to be, do the other tests back that up, or do the other tests show something else? So these are all the things that we're going to kind of discuss and look at as we go through and talk about the material itself. Okay, so let's start off with the characterization and let's start off with a reminder of what it was that we actually did. We took salicylic acid and reacted it in the presence of acetic anhydride. With an acid catalyst at 50 degrees C for 8 to 10 minutes. And after workup, hopefully we recovered acetyl salicylic acid. And so in sequence, what I think we should talk about is we should go through and we should look at the melting point. We should look at the ferric chloride test, and we should look at the FTIR. And in the FTIR, we have to do two jobs. So the first job is how to sample a solid. And the other is what do we expect in terms of the spectrum? So what is that spectrum going to look like? So the spectrum itself, spectrum analysis. So those are the jobs that we got to do today. So that's what we're going to focus on. Let's talk about the melting point first and what we expect in the melting point. So in looking at the two materials are expected to have different melting points. The question is, which one is supposed to have what melting point? So rather than just taking the melting points, which is what we would do, we can ask the question, well, what do we expect the melting points to look like for each one of these materials? And we know that the melting point is a factor of the intermolecular strength of the intermolecular forces. The strength of the intermolecular forces in the molecule, and how much energy it takes to pull the two molecules apart. So when we look at the two molecules, the salicylic acid has a significant amount of hydrogen bonding. So it's got a number of oxygens and a number of hydroxyl groups. We can also count this oxygen up here in terms of its lone pairs. So it can have a significant amount of hydrogen bonding. The the product that we made, the acetyl salicylic acid, likewise has an hydroxyl group and also a number of oxygens. But in regards to the oxygens, we have donors for hydrogen bonds and acceptors for hydrogen bonds. And we can have a number of acceptors. Oh, actually, that's a donor. I'll take that back. So we've got two donors, one acceptor. Here we've only got one donor and a number of different acceptors for hydrogen bonds. But because there's only one donor, our hydrogen bonding capacity has decreased. So in acetyl salicylic acid, we have less hydrogen bonding. We also have more mass though. And in terms of the melting point, if you have less hydrogen bonding, the melting point should go down, but the melting point should go up if there's more mass. So the question is, well, what do we expect? The melting point on the salicylic acid is 158.6. Let's call it 157 to 158, because we know that these are supposed to be ranges. So let's keep our melting points as ranges. Literature value is 156, but we'll call it 157 to 158. So what do we expect for the acetyl salicylic acid? Do we expect the melting point to go down or to go up? If we think hydrogen bonding is more important, the melting point should go down. If we think that the increase in mass by adding the acete group is going to increase the melting point, then we would expect it to go up. So the question is, well, which one is more important? And the acete group is a C2H2O that has been added. We have one hydrogen that just gets shuffled in place in terms of that. So really the mass difference is C2H2O, which is 24 plus 2, that's 26 plus another 16. That's what, 48 grams per mole in terms of that. So we've added 48 grams per mole to the molecule. And the question is, well, what do we expect? Do we expect the melting point to go up or do we expect the melting point to go down? Any guesses on what's more important? Matt, forces are more important. Yeah, exactly. So I would say that the intermolecular attractive forces are more important than the mass in this regard, because the mass is just not that much that we're adding. So I would expect overall that because there's less hydrogen bonding, that we expect the melting point to go down. And that is indeed what happens. The new melting point is 134.5 to 135.5. So we expect a lower melting point in that regard. So yeah, actually good guess there. So we take the melting point and then once we get the melting point, we have several questions that we have to ask. So is the melting point exact what it's supposed to be? And if the melting point is what it's supposed to be, then we have fairly high confidence. So let's say that we get 134.5 to 135.5, then the expectation is, that was degrees C, the expectation is that the product is as expected. If we get something that is like 128 to 132 degrees Celsius, this is depressed, broad, and depressed from expected, or we could say from literature value. And that would imply that this is somehow impure and contains contaminants, possibly starting material. If we wind up getting a melting point which is around 100 and let's say 50, 147 maybe. 147 to 154 degrees Celsius. This is broad and depressed from starting material. And what this might indicate is this might indicate that the majority of the material is starting material. That the majority of the recovered product is starting material. And that maybe only a small amount of salicylic acid is in there, acting as an impurity. So, or the acetyl salicylic acid. Impurity in starting material. Essentially, what we're saying here is that the reaction failed. And so for each melting point that we get, we have sort of an expectation of what does that melting point mean. And so we've gone through sort of what each one of those melting points means. And as we go through each of the different factors, we want to make sure that the factors are correlating. And so we'll talk a lot about whether the factors are correlating or not, each one of the characterization tests. Okay, let's look at the next one, which is what we call a ferric chloride test. Ferric chloride test is a test for phenols. So phenol, remember, is the aromatic with the hydroxyl group. And it really is a specific test for phenols. It doesn't test for anything else. Ferric chloride, the ferric ion, is the Fe2+, otherwise known as iron Roman numeral 3. And the ferrous ion is Fe2+. Oops, I did them wrong. That was supposed to be the 3+. Ferrous is the 2+. This is the iron 2. And so when we're looking at ferric chloride is FeCl3. And this is an aqueous solution. It's clear and has a yellow tinge just from the iron in the solution. The ferric chloride itself is a yellow compound, and it imparts a slight yellow tinge to the solution itself. And when the ferric ion combines with a phenol, it reacts with three of these plus the ferric ion, iron, there we go, in aqueous solution in water. And it produces a complex where three of these phenols bind to the iron. So three of them are combining with the iron. This is still a 3+ ion. And they form a complex. It's a Lewis acid base complex. And that complex is a deep red color. It is very distinctive. It is a clear, deep red color, almost sort of a magenta. Can be magenta, can be red, depending upon the type of phenol. So depending upon what functional groups, and we can have various functional groups that are attached to the phenols. And so various functional groups will change this, and some of them will be deep red, some of them will be magenta. Some of them will be slightly purple. And so there's a range of colors, but all very vibrant in their color and very easy to distinguish from the yellow color of the ferric chloride test. And it's extremely distinctive and accurate for phenols. Doesn't happen for any other compound. So if we were to take salicylic acid, and it's always good to do a positive test to see what your expectation is. When we take salicylic acid and we react three of them with the iron 3+, we get that deep red color. We get that complex forming. I think it's called a tris complex. And there's three of these that combine with the iron, and the whole complex turns red. But when we go and we do this test with...
Hey Jason, is that an arrow that you're making right next to the iron three?
It's not an arrow. It's a bracket and then a three that is subscripted that is telling me that I have three of those groups. So it's as if I were to say I have X binding to something, and then I don't know why I can't make a good sort of swoop. Three of these groups, meaning that there are three X's binding to whatever the metal is. It's just a way of not having to draw it three times because there's three big groups there.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. So the way that we literally do the test is to take a small amount of material, sort of the same thing that you would use if we were doing a solubility test. It's like the amount of material that I would use in a melting point capillary tube. And we take a ferric chloride solution. I can't remember the concentration. It's a fairly dilute solution though. And we use like 1 mL of the FeCl3 aqueous. And then we add in the material and vortex. And the color is immediate and very bright. And so if we get a positive test, my dogs are gonna be so barky. Positive test, negative test. So under positive, we get this bright, brilliant red color that comes out in this thing. And in a negative test, the negative test just stays yellow and is the color of the original solution. Okay. And the amount of solid that we're using is sort of a melting point capillary tube worth. And these are what are called a colorimetric test. Colorimetric tests by design are extremely sensitive, and your eye can pick up very easily differentiations in shades of color, and even small amounts of compounds can give a tremendous amount of color in solution like this. And so even if this is slightly positive, even if there's a small amount of phenol, the yellow color will change and tinge red, and it's easily distinguishable from the blank, from the negative test. So what we do is we do our test, and we take the acetylsalicylic acid product that we've made, and we go ahead and throw it in with the ferric chloride. And what we find is that hopefully it remains yellow and that there is no hint of red or magenta inside that mixture. And the reason is that what was reacting was the phenol. And so the phenol functional group is the reactive component that is doing that reaction and that is causing the color with the ferric ion. And we've lost that. We've replaced the phenol now with the ester. And so there's no phenol. And we should get a negative ferric chloride test. And if we do get any hint of color indicates contamination with starting material. So what we would expect to see is we would expect to see this negative test. And if we get anything other than the negative test, if we get any faint contamination in there, then what we would expect to see is that we get some coloration. Maybe we can go to a faint color that we can see that the color here would be something other than the negative. This would imply that there is some phenol contamination. I'm gonna close my office door and see. It's not gonna block them entirely, but it's gonna help. Hang on. And if they get really bad, we'll try and banish them to the bedroom. It's just, they know when one of the family members is gone, they expect a family member to come home. And so every time they hear a car door, and the neighborhood is fairly busy, every time there's a car door, they sound off. They got to let me know every time a door opens or closes outside. It gets really annoying really fast. Okay. So are we understanding the test? Are we understanding the ferric chloride test? It's pretty easy in terms of its colorimetric test. The only thing that we haven't discussed is where the color comes from. And that was a question that I got this morning, which is a great question, is why does this complex make a color? And the why the complex makes a color is a much, much more difficult question to answer. It sort of goes back to understanding metals, understanding d orbitals, and the d orbital splitting that happens when a metal binds to a ligand. And so basically what happens is if we look at the iron as a 3 plus ion, and we look at the orbitals within that. Let me see if I don't have a periodic table here to be able to tell. Maybe I do. I'm grabbing a quick periodic table. You guys won't be able to see it, but I'm going to write it down and tell you where it is. Okay, so iron is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's a D6. So this is argon core with a 4D0, 3D5, because we've lost 3 electrons. So we lost 3 electrons. It's original, and this now is the ion, so this is the 3 plus ion. It was originally a 4D2, 3D6, and we lost 3 electrons, presumably out of the D1 and out of the S that we lost. So we have the D5. And when we combine it with 3 oxygens, and we assume that 3 times oxygen, and that it is the 2 electrons that are binding, so the 3 times 2 is going to imply that this is 6 electrons. Maybe it's more electrons than that I'm getting. There must be more electrons from other water molecules, or the chlorides must still be there in some way, because that's only coming out to 6 plus 5 is 11, and I'm supposed to get 18, so I'm missing a whole bunch of electrons that come out in that. But what's supposed to happen is that when the iron binds to oxygens, and I get 3 different oxygens with R groups on here, presumably in a trigonal planar sort of fashion, that what that does is sets up a difference between the highest occupied molecular orbital and energy coming into these would stimulate an electron to promote it to a higher energy state. So this is in an excited state. And being in an excited state like that, the electron has absorbed energy relative to the difference between the two energy levels. So this is the change in energy, which equals some wavelength that has been absorbed, basically. So this is the energy absorbed. And once that energy is absorbed, essentially what's happening on a surface is that if we say that this material is some red material that we're looking at, that there are many different wavelengths of light that are striking this material. So we have red wavelengths of light, we have blue wavelengths of light, we have yellow wavelengths of light or green wavelengths of light. And what we see or perceive as the color of the object is the light that is reflected into our vision. And the other ones have presumably been absorbed. And so what we're saying over here is that these wavelengths, the blue wavelength and the green wavelength, would be the energy wavelengths that would be absorbed and are not transmitted or bounced off or reflected off to our eye. And so what is happening is that these ligands, these guys here, which we call ligands on the metal, are changing the wavelength absorption here to filter out certain wavelengths, leaving the one wavelength that is not absorbed or the multiple wavelengths that are not absorbed to be able to reach our eye. And that's what we perceive as color. And it is the phenol that changes that wavelength into the visible range. Other molecules presumably can coordinate to the iron as well, but those other ligands would not change it into a visible spectrum wavelength absorption. And therefore, we don't perceive any color change from other types of molecules. And so while the oxygen that is the hydroxyl group on the carboxylic acid may coordinate to the phenol, the change in the wavelength is not in a visible wavelength range. And so we perceive no color change from the original ferric ion. So Finn, is the color absorbing all the colors except for the color we see? It's absorbing some colors and filtering out some. And what we see is a blending of the remaining colors that are reflected. So that is generally not a single wavelength. It is multiple wavelengths, but we may perceive it to be more red or more blue or more green when the other wavelengths are filtered out. So that's what's technically happening there. And so, you know, there's several different outcomes that could happen. If we do this test, we could get that we get a negative test, in which case this would be consistent with the product. So the negative test would be consistent with the expected product. Acetylsalicylic acid. We could get the test where we get some phenol contamination, which is telling us then that there's some starting material. So this would imply that some salicylic acid present. It's also possible that I could get one other result coming out of this, that the reaction could have entirely failed. And if the reaction failed, then the other thing that could come out of this is that I could get a test that shows me that this material is mostly really dark red. And that would indicate that this is almost all phenol and that the reaction failed. And starting material recovered. So we could have anything in between. And the thing that we want to be able to do is we want to be able to assess from our melting point and correlate that with our ferric chloride test. So in correlating those, what we would say is that if we were looking at the melting point, let's take this, and this would be consistent with a melting point that might be 130, what did we say it was, 134 to 135, that those two would correlate to each other. The one over here might correlate to a slightly lower and broader melting point because of contamination. So this might be in the range of 127 to 132 degrees Celsius. And if it was all, almost all starting material, then we're up closer to the 158. So let's say that this one was the 47 to 152 sort of degrees Celsius, implying that most of it is starting material. So we can correlate each one of these outcomes and making sure that the outcome matches the other tests. It would be highly unusual for us to get a melting point that was 134 to 135 degrees. It would be unusual to get this melting point and to have it show up as being mostly phenol in the ferric chloride test. Something would be wrong and be off there because both things could not be true simultaneously. So we want to make sure that all of our data that we're getting out of this is matching and is telling us the same things. Is that making sense? Let's see where we're at. Okay, cool. All right, so that's the ferric chloride test. The next part of this is to look at the FTIR. And in FTIR analysis, the solid phase FTIR is much more difficult than is the liquid phase. In the liquid phase, what we did is we took a sodium chloride plate and that sodium chloride plate, we just put a drop of material onto the sodium chloride plate and then made a sandwich out of it. So we just put a single drop of liquid and then we built the sandwich and then we put that into the FTIR. And so the liquid drop on sodium chloride plate was a super easy prep and it all goes together really, really quickly. And it's very easy to do. And the reason that it works is because we make such a thin layer that that liquid drop, when we put the second plate on top of it, just makes a sandwich that makes a very thin layer there. So I think, and the thinness of the layer is what's really critical. So we just kind of drop this one on top of it. Pretend like those guys don't exist. And then we get a very thin layer. Let's make it sort of orangey material that's existing inside of that and gets all spread out. And then that's what we run the light through. And it's that thin layer that really allows this technique to work. And also the sodium chloride, which has no absorbance in the IR range. So sodium chloride with no absorbance in the 4,000 on down to 650 reciprocal centimeters. Actually, I think within sodium chloride, I think we can go down to 400 reciprocal centimeters. It's the potassium bromide that is up to 650, and that's what we're about to do next. So when we do a solid, the problem is that we can't crush a solid and make a solid thin enough to be able to fit between two sodium chloride plates. If we put a couple of grains of solid in there and then tried to crush it, we would break the sodium chloride plates and we wouldn't be able to do anything with that. And also, we can't do it in solution because all the solutions that we would use would be organic solvents, and those organic solvents would absorb at their own frequencies. And so we would see the solvent more than we would see anything else. So we can't do it in solution either, which means that we need to find a way to take a solid and to suspend a solid in some matrix that is non-absorbing in the IR range. That's the challenge. So how do we tackle and do that? Let me go get an image. I spent this morning drawing a few things so that we were ready to go. I've been practicing my drawing skills. This has actually been kind of fun because I don't get to draw quite like this in class. Not to this extent. So here's what we do is a solid potassium bromide pellet is what we make. And the solid potassium bromide pellet is made from potassium bromide cuttings. And there's a process through which we go in order to make a pellet. And we choose potassium bromide for a number of different reasons. Number one, it's cheap, relatively. Number two, it can be obtained in a dry form. I'm trying to think about the words, anhydrous form. Because water is a pain. Number three, it's fairly easy to work with and has no IR absorbance. In the 4,000 on down to 650 reciprocal centimeters, which is the window in which we're interested in. And the last thing is, it makes good pellets. It's easy to fuse back together once you grind it up into a powder. You can then press it using really high pressure and you can fuse it back into a pellet. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to make a solution of our compound in potassium bromide and then fuse it into a solid once it's evenly distributed. That's kind of our goal. And to do that, our main tool is a mortar and pestle. And the mortar and pestle that we use is we have these beautiful tiny agate mortar and pestles. And agate is a natural stone material. So rather than using a mortar and pestle that is made out of ceramic, we use the agate mortar and pestle because agate, much like the mineral sodium or potassium bromide or sodium chloride, is a mineral that has no absorbances in the IR range within where we're absorbing and looking. And so the agate, actually, you can see into the agate a little bit. It's really clear, cool. They're beautiful, sort of sky blue agate materials. They have little occlusions in them. So there's dark areas and there's light areas and there's some whiter areas. They're made from a natural stone product. And so it has that sort of natural stone look to it. They're not very large. We have a couple of different sizes, some that are pretty darn tiny and some that are a little bit bigger. I find the slightly larger ones a little bit easier to work with. But you can wind up using more KBR than you need to in the larger one. So it's up to each person's preference as to what mortar and pestle size they like to use. And the reason that we use potassium bromide cuttings rather than getting potassium bromide as a powder, both are available, but the powder absorbs water very quickly. And water is a problem. Water, like I said, we like the material to be anhydrous. If the material has water in it, water shows up in the IR. It absorbs just exactly where the hydroxyl absorbs, right around the 3400 to 3200 range. And so having water get into this would be problematic. So we want something that is anhydrous. And the KBR cuttings are made from when they make the sodium chloride plates, and they make those plates the same as they would make a potassium bromide plate that is finely polished. They make these plates as well. And these are the cutoffs. So after making the plate, these are the cuttings. And the cuttings are generally cubes that are about 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter square. Sometimes they're various shapes. Sometimes they're a little bit smaller than that. But the idea behind the cuttings is they have less surface area. Than a powder, which means that they absorb less water. on long term. So opening and closing the bottle, less water is going to be absorbed by these materials that are square and have these faces on them rather than a powder. So that's why we use the potassium bromide cuttings. And the process is we take the potassium bromide and we use a pair of tweezers to pull it out, because if you grab it by your hand, you're just going to put moisture onto the KBR pellets. And so we don't want to contaminate the pellets. So we go in and out of the bottle with a pair of tweezers. And once we open the lid and we take crystal out, we make sure that we put the lid back on and tighten the lid, because we want to make sure that water is not getting into that. So we're always very careful about keeping the lid sealed as much as possible. Now, a single pellet is more than we actually need. So what we need to do is we need to split the pellets. And to split the pellets, we give this a sharp tap. Or we whack it, basically. W-H-A-C-K. So we whack it. And sometimes it's a couple of hits that we give it. And when we do that, it fractures the pellet into a number of different pieces. Usually, it only fractured into three or four pieces. And then those other pieces that we're not going to use, we take and we put them back in the jar. So this is one area where we say that generally we tell you never put a reagent back into a reagent bottle. This is the one place where I do want you to put reagent back into the reagent bottle, as long as the mortar and pestle is clean, and as long as you're using a clean pair of tweezers, go ahead and take the excess and put it back in the jar, snug the lid back up on it. So we get an amount that is maybe about a third of a crystal. That's what we're looking for. So select maybe about a third. Put the rest back. Then what we do is we start the process of grinding. And because the crystal is fairly large, it is very difficult to grind with the mortar and pestle in the fashion in which we normally think of a mortar and pestle. Normally, you think about a mortar and pestle as sort of a grinding and a rotating motion. Well, the first thing that you need to do here is you need to tap or whack this thing a few times in order to break it up and get it into a consistency which is a little bit like kosher salt. And then once you get it into kosher salt, then you can start the process of grinding it. So first a few whacks to get it into smaller chunks, and then a rotational and grinding motion in order to grind it up. And as you're grinding it up, it's going to go through several sorts of sizes. You're going to start sort of as a kosher salt. And then as you grind it down, sort of falls into a table salt sort of range. And as we keep grinding, then what we get is into some sort of fine salt. And eventually you get it down, after working it for quite a while, you get it down into like a talc sort of powder. And the image that I'm showing here is the idea of observing the crystals as you're grinding it to look to see what stage you're in. And one of the main things that I watch for, that I look for, is this glinting sort of idea. And glinting like snow or ice in the sun. So when you look at the snow or the ice in the sun, what you're seeing is you're seeing a fine crystal structure. And that fine crystal structure, if we have the facets of a crystal and there's still little crystals in there, then the light will shine off of them, and you'll see that as like a little starburst. It catches your eye, reflects the light. And what that's telling you is that the structures are still too large, that it needs to be a dull gray material before you're done grinding. So what we do is we continue grinding until we get it down into that talc sort of shape where there's no glinting. So this is sort of the ideal sort of size. The ideal size is a powder that is dull and no glinting. That's when you know you're ready to move forward. So we keep grinding until we get it down into that dull sort of of no glinting idea. And then we apply a sample to it. Or we don't apply a sample and we make a blank. So we're gonna come back and talk about a blank pellet. Let's just keep talking about making the sample and the sample prep, and then we'll talk about a blank prep, because whenever we do a KBR, we always run a blank in the spectrophotometer before we actually put our sample in. And we do the same thing with sodium chloride plates. I just never talked about it. I forgot to tell you that. That typically what we do is we take the sodium chloride plates, assemble them dry, put them in the spectrophotometer, run a background scan. The background scan is stored in the spectrophotometer and subtracted from the scan that we run with our material in it. And that way, any occlusions in the crystal or any absorbances by the crystal are subtracted from your spectrum. And the background is stored within the spectrophotometer such that only the first person needs to run the background scan. Everybody else just runs their scan as normal, and you never have to subtract it. There's no button to hit to subtract the background. It's done automatically. So as soon as you run your scan, it automatically subtracts the background scan from it. To do a background scan for the potassium bromide, we would just go through this entire process without ever putting sample in it, make a pellet, run the pellet as the background, then go back, make another one, putting our sample in it. So here's the sample introduction though. And the sample introduction is much the same as many of the other sorts of samples that we do. It's a melting point capillary tube worth. It's like this great measuring quantity. It's very easy once you've done melting points and you remember sort of how big a melting point capillary tube is and how much material goes into that. That's how much we want to put in here. Ideally, what you're looking for is 1% by mass of sample, which is too hard to measure. It's too small. So you eyeball it and you throw a small amount in there. And what I say is that if the compound were a colored compound, let's say that the compound was some brilliant red compound, you would want to add enough of it to the KBR to impart the faintest hint of blush red that you could to the compound when it was evenly distributed. That's the goal or the idea. And that's sort of the 1% idea. However, almost all organic compounds are clear, colorless, or white as a solid. And so you can't see it. You can't tell when you put it in whether you put in too much or too little. And so it becomes an experiential thing. It becomes just a practice thing. You know how much you need to put in by having done 100 IRs, or in our case, by the time we get done with the class, at least 20 or 30 of them. And having done it a significant number of times, you start to gain experience of how much sample do you really need. If the sample is very dense, we use less. If the sample is very light and fluffy, not very dense, we need more. And so visually, the amount that you use is relative to how dense the materials or how dense the crystals are. We put that material in, and then once we add that material, we regrind. So we regrind to distribute sample homogeneously. Once it's distributed homogeneously, now you're sort of done with the sample prep, and now it's time to actually make the pellet. So then we would use this sample to go ahead and make the pellet once it's all distributed evenly. So let's go grab the next image. We'll go back to my drawings and we'll grab the die set. So here what we're doing is working with what's called a KBR die. And the die, this is a die set. And this one is a 10-ton, rated at 10-ton die set. And it has a number of different parts to it. It has a body. The body comes in two parts. There's the top and the bottom. The top is a solid piece of stainless steel. They're heavy, as you might imagine. And the hole that is in the top of this extends all the way through the body and is very tightly matched towards the anvils and the ram. So the diameter of that hole is very precisely made, as are the anvils and ram. And the body has a stainless steel piece of metal sitting in the bottom of this. And that stainless steel piece is in a aluminum body to give it a little bit less weight. So the ring is an aluminum body, and inside is a stainless steel piece of metal that is just a big circular piece. And the anvils are also made of stainless steel. And then there's what's called a ram. So there are two anvils, identical in size and shape. And there is a, what we call the ram, which is the piece that applies the pressure to the overall apparatus. So when we look at the anvils have two sides. This is a blow up of the anvil. And the anvil has two sides to it. It has a mirror polished side. And it has a dull side. The mirrored side, this is what we call the working side. It's optically polished such that we want the polished side to point towards our pellet when we make our pellet. So it's important that when you go to use the anvil, that you observe the anvil, which side of the anvil needs to point which direction. And that'll be clearer as we go through and do these drawings. So the first thing to do is to assemble the body. Actually, what you want to do, the first thing you want to do is make sure that everything is clean and that there's no contamination of any of the powders or any of the samples on any of the pieces. And we use the acetone that had saturated sodium chloride in it in order to clean the body and to clean anything that we need to. Not because we need the saturated sodium chloride, but because it's convenient and it's sitting there and we use it for the solid, for the sodium chloride plates anyway, and the sodium chloride doesn't hurt anything. And so that's the cleaning solution that we use. When you press these bodies together, the two body pieces have an audible click when they seat. And so you want to give it some downward force. Normally what I do is I just lean on it with the palm of my hand and put my shoulder force into it. And you can hear it audibly click when the body sets together. And it's just held together by friction. So there's no screws or anything to set it together. Once you get the body clicked together, then the next step is to add an anvil. And we add it polished side up. And that's really important because we want to make sure that the polished side is going to be pointed towards our crystal such that the crystal, when it is made with no scratches or dings or dents in the surface of the crystal that would cause scattering of light. So we don't want to have any scattering of light. So we use the anvil with its polished side up because the powder is going to go on top of this and we want the polished side to point towards the powder. Then what we do is we add 0.20 grams of sample plus the KBR. So this is the KBR mixture with our sample. And we weigh this out on not an analytical balance, but a pan balance that sits in the stock room. And we want to make sure that we get 0.20 grams and that it's pretty close within that. I would not want much tolerance here. That's maybe 0.01 grams tolerance because usually the blank, whoever makes the blank is also 0.20 grams. And we don't want the pellet to be a different thickness than the blank. We'll talk about why a little bit later, but it's very important that the pellet and the blank have the same thickness so that they have the same path length so that the light going through it sees essentially the same amount of impurities so they get subtracted correctly. That's the short answer of that. So the powder all goes in. Once the powder goes in, this is a blow up of what's going on inside the chamber. So we've got the anvil sitting inside the chamber. And when you dump the powder into it, the powder never goes in flat. The powder always sits up against a sidewall. And it doesn't matter how much you shake it or how much you tap it or swirl it. Nothing really matters. You can never get the powder to lay down flat. It's just impossible. So we have a system for leveling out the powder, because if you don't level out the powder, bad things happen. I failed to tell the morning class why you need to do this, but if you try to smash the pellet now, what winds up happening is you wind up creating a pellet that is inside the chamber that is thick on one side and goes down to crumbles on the other side. And you, instead of getting a nice fine sort of pellet that is homogeneous in thickness all the way through, we get this garbage sort of pellet that is not homogeneous and just does not press properly. So we need to get the powder evenly distributed across the bottom. And so what we do is we take and we use the ram to level the powder. We insert the ram with the flat side down. The ram has two sides. The ram has a beveled side and a flat side. We make sure that we put the flat side down so that as the flat side contacts the powder, the flat side is going to smooth the powder out. And if you do the ram, if you do the beveled side, you're just going to create a dent in the powder rather than flattening the entire powder out all the way. So we use a rotation motion and we use some downwards force. We apply some force with rotation. And it just takes a couple of rotations and the powder flattens out all nice and smooth. The trick is getting the ram back out, because presumably the ram is in here in very tight tolerances. So it's very close to the edge, almost no room. And the ram is sitting in here. And as we withdraw the ram, oftentimes it will pull the pellet up with it. And when the pellet falls, we get disruption of our nice even layer. So in order to not have that happen, what we do is when we pull the ram out, we take and we put our thumb over this guy. So we apply some thumb pressure to, this is a vacuum port. And the vacuum port is open to the inner chamber inside here. And when you put your finger over it, it creates a vacuum, creates essentially suction, such that as I draw up the ram, the anvil stays in place, as long as you keep your thumb over the hole while you draw the ram out. So we put a thumb over the hole, we draw out the ram. Over vacuum port. And withdraw the ram. All right, after that, next anvil goes in. With the polished side, well, you tell me, which side is the polished side gonna go towards? Down or up this time? What do you think? Think about what it is you're trying to achieve.
Polished side down.
Polished side down, exactly. Because what you want to achieve is you want to have the polished sides pointed towards your powder. So we want the polished side to go down towards the powder. So now we have the powder centered in there in between the two anvils. And the next thing is we add the ram. And this time we need to be extra careful that the ram goes with the beveled side up. This is critical. I can't emphasize this enough. That is not the right color. Now you can't read it. Wasn't doing effectively what I wanted it to do. We'll just color it in this way. Beveled side has to go up. The ram gets wrecked if you don't put it the beveled side up. Well, I'll show you how in a minute, but when the apparatus is complete, this is where we're at. We've got beveled side up, we've got the two anvils in, powder evenly distributed, and the whole apparatus is ready to go. So that's the critical component. Let's go grab the next image. So I need this guy. This is how I spent office hours, was drawing a new press, because I didn't have a press to show them this morning. I had to draw the press on the fly, and drawing a press on the fly, it never comes out as pretty as when you're just kind of sketching. So since nobody was there to ask me anything in office hours, I drew a press. Okay, so the press is really big and really heavy. It is a 20-ton press, and it is made out of a 20-ton house jack in a very heavy steel housing. And the whole thing probably weighs darn near close to 100 pounds. It's a big apparatus, and you need to be careful when using it because it's also on a wooden base. And sometimes we move the wooden base around, and I'm always terrified that somebody's going to like turn it to get at either the handle or the pressure release valve, and going to drop it on the ground by having it slide fast. Because sometimes you have to apply a lot of pressure to turn it, and it's been sitting on the counter for a long time, and it sticks. And all of a sudden, when it breaks loose, it rotates really fast. And if it ever rotates on the ground, I swear it's going through the ground. It just weighs that much. It's beefy. Okay, so the whole thing is a big steel housing. And this piece here is also called the ram. We have a pressure release. That's a valve that's there. It's a hydraulic jack that's in it. This is the handle that applies the pressure. And then we've got the gauge with the tons on ram. And this is the pressure plate that is in here. So what is inside this thing is this guy over here. This is a house jack, a hydraulic house jack. And basically what this thing does is has a series of chambers in it and a couple of ball bearings in a steel housing that when you lift the handle, oil is drawn in. So if you imagine that I have a hole and I have a ball bearing that is sitting on this, and this goes down to some oil reservoir. So there's oil that's sitting down here. When I lift up on the handle, oil is drawn out and the ball bearing lifts up. When I push down on the handle, there is another section that has a ball bearing that is at the bottom, basically, of it. And when I push down on the handle, the downwards force forces the oil out another hole, and there's another ball bearing that releases that. And as pressure builds up on this side, the pressure cannot go backwards against that ball bearing. And so what happens is every time you push the handle down, you increase the pressure by forcing oil, and the oil then forces this chamber up. And because oil is an incompressible liquid, most liquids are incompressible to most degree, that the hydraulic fluid causes a huge increase in pressure with each pump of the handle. And so that is what is sitting inside here. And you're looking at the same handle and the pressure plate that is underneath this giant housing. And so what we do is, number one, we close the handle. We'll close the pressure valve. It's a clockwise turn until it's locked. Second thing that we do is we insert and center the die. So we take our die that's here and we set it into the housing, drop it in place, And then what we do is we bring the ram down until the ram touches the housing, the die. And we make sure that that whole thing is really centered in there before we start. And then we apply pressure and we crank it up to 10 tons. And you leave it at 10 tons for about a minute, maybe 2 minutes. It doesn't take a whole lot of time. Minute, when you're sitting there and you're sitting around for 2 minutes and you're waiting for it, it seems like it's a really long time. Sort of like when you put food in the microwave for 2 minutes and you sit there and you watch it, it seems like a really long time, even though it's not. We crank it up to 10 tons and leave it for 1 to 2 minutes. And then you release the pressure. And to release the pressure, it's a quarter turn counterclockwise of the pressure relief valve. It's really important not to overturn the pressure release valve. What happens is people forget whether tightening it is clockwise or counterclockwise. And when they release the pressure, it's pretty easy to figure out how to release the pressure. But what happens is if you turn it two turns, now people don't know whether they need to turn it clockwise or counterclockwise when they go to tighten it. So they go to tighten it and they turn it like a quarter turn, half turn clockwise, thinking it's going to tighten, and it doesn't tighten. So in their brains, they're going, oh shit, I'm doing the wrong thing. I need to go the other way. And so they start going the other way. And when they go the other way, you've already turned it two times, releasing it, a few more turns, and the hydraulic valve comes out. And when the hydraulic valve comes out, you know what comes out after the pressure relief valve comes out? All the hydraulic fluid. And when all the hydraulic fluid comes out, then somebody, AKA me, has to go in and disassemble the entire apparatus, put hydraulic fluid in it, and clean up all the fluid that's spilled inside the apparatus and put it all back together, which is really not fun. So quarter turns, quarter turn to lock it up, quarter turn to release it, and try not to get it too lost. And I already, this guy broke last year. We bought it, I guess almost 10 years ago now, maybe even longer than that, maybe 15 years ago. We bought this thing, and when we bought it, I sort of thought it was going to last forever, not realizing that when you use a house jack as much as we use a house jack, that after 15 years, all the seals in the house jack break down, and they're about $10,000 to replace the entire unit, and you could just replace the house jack inside of it, but even the house jack was a few thousand dollars because they're modified. They have pieces welded into them in order to fit into this, and pieces in order to get the gauge to work properly. So I took the thing home, disassembled the entire thing, and rebuilt it last year and put all new seals in it. So it's got brand new seals in the entire thing. I took the house jack entirely apart and found a kit online and rebuilt the entire thing. So we're back in business. And that's enough bragging. I'm sorry. I get on my stuff about not taking the handle out and not letting the oil out of it, because it's really a pain to take apart. And then once we're done, once you get this thing out, you open up the housing, and it's just grabbing it, twisting it, and pulling apart. And once you pull it apart, what you get is a pellet that comes out of this thing. That is not a pellet. Let's see if I can make a pellet. A pellet that is really thin. There we go. We got a really thin pellet. The pellet is just like half a millimeter thick, maybe even smaller than that. And that pellet is really optically pure. I mean, it's really, you can see right through it. And sometimes, like when it's a blank, if we get a blank pellet And I know I'm drawing this sort of like an oval that looks like a pill, but I'm trying to show a pellet that is sort of on its side. So you have to imagine that the line that I'm looking at here is, this is on the back side of the pellet. So that's a dashed line sort of showing the back side of the pellet. That the pellet is really optically clear. And let's see, Matt, you had a question, I'm sorry. Nice, it uses like a mineral oil. It's the oil that it uses is a hydraulic fluid. They sell special fluid for hydraulic house jacks, and it's a pneumatic fluid is what I'm trying to say. So the pneumatic fluid that is incompressible for pneumatic devices, that they use the same sort of fluid in tractors that have all the mechanical pneumatic arms and everything. All of that stuff is working off of incompressible fluids in order to get immediate distribution of energy from whatever pump it is that you're using. So you push on the pump and you get an immediate effect on the other end and transmission of high amount of pressure from the hydraulic fluid because it's incompressible. So that's what we're using. So let's say that this is a blank pellet that's here. The pellet that we would get that would have our sample in it sometimes has little areas in it that are a little bit darker, a little bit grayer. We'll have some amount of material that you can see that is actually dissolved inside that. And it doesn't look 100% homogeneous, but it's really darn close. And so the sample pellet is generally not as clear as the blank. In general. And one of the things that we had said is that when we have the blank pellet, that as the light comes through the blank pellet, it's going through this path length of a half millimeter. That when the light goes through our sample pellet, we want the path length to be the same between the blank and our sample. So what happens here is there's two things that we're fighting. We're fighting water and we're fighting carbon dioxide. Water as a gas that is dissolving into this and as a liquid that's settling within the pellets, but also CO2. And when you run the blank, like I said, the potassium bromide has very few absorptions within the infrared spectrum range that we're looking at. But water and CO2 have very strong absorbances in that range. The water shows up right around the 3,400 to 3,200 range in reciprocal centimeters. And CO2 shows up like around 2,400 reciprocal centimeters. And they're both strong. And so because the KBR absorbs water, we want to make sure that we're subtracting that water by using a blank. And we also want to make sure that we're subtracting CO2 to some degree by using the blank. And so what winds up happening is, let's say that we have a blank pellet and we have the same path length, blank with same path length as sample. Then what happens is, let's do the blank in blue. So we'll do an IR spectrum of the blank. And the IR is going to have a small amount of water in it. And it might have a small amount of CO2 in it. And then it has some other small absorbances that are really non-relevant. So here's where water shows up, and here's where CO2 shows up. And then we have our sample, and our sample is going to have So let's say the sample pellet is also a blank pellet. Let's say that the sample doesn't have any sample in it. I know that sounds sort of weird, but hang with me for a second here. So let's say that I take these two, copy it, and throw this over here. And this is my sample spectrum. And we'll actually color this, style it. I was trying to style it. Style it red. So this is my sample. This is my blank. Then as I subtract the blank from the sample, the result is a flat straight line. I have adequately removed everything and I get a flat line. That's sort of ideal. That's what I want to happen. So that we can imagine that if the sample contained some carbon hydrogen stretches that were in here, and I had a carbonyl that was in here, and then I had these other peaks that are in there, so that the sample was a combination of these two things, then as I get rid of the red line, what I get is my spectrum. And my spectrum is uncontaminated from water and from CO2 because the two were of the same path length. If the two are not of the same path length, then some bad things wind up happening. Let's take this entire image. Let's copy this and show a couple of different issues. So two other possibilities. One possibility is that the blank, that did not do what I wanted it to do. One possibility is that the blank is thicker. So let's imagine that I have these two pellets here. We'll grab these to demonstrate the process. We'll put them above. So I have blank and I have sample. And let's say that the blank is thicker. So I have this really thick blank. Something like this. So this is a thick blank. What that means is that my path length is longer. And what that does is that makes the water that is in my blank and the CO2 that is in my blank a lot larger. So the absorbances that I would see for water would come down. That's going to bother me if I get that in there. The absorbances for water are going to come down a long ways, and the CO2 may even come down quite a bit further. Okay, and yet the path length for my sample is smaller, and so the amount of water and CO2 that I see in my sample are smaller. Now, instead of getting a blank line, a flat line, what I get is I get an inversion. So I'm going to partially delete. I get an inversion in this spot and an inversion in this spot. So the inversion is that the CO2 and the water subtract more than they are supposed to, and I get an inverted hydroxyl and an inverted CO2. Not ideal from a publication perspective in terms of spectra. Ideally, what we'd like to do is we'd like to subtract the right amount of water and subtract the right amount of CO2. And so by having the blank and the sample be of different sizes, it's problematic. It makes the spectrum not look pretty. Not that you couldn't analyze it, not that you couldn't understand what was going on, But you get these inverted peaks, and everybody goes, why am I getting inverted peaks? Why am I not getting a flat baseline? Well, that's, excuse me, that's why you're not getting a flat baseline. The opposite is also true and actually worse. So let's say that the situation is reversed. Let's say that the blank was thin and your sample pellet was the thing that was thicker. So now let's reverse these. We'll take this guy. And now what we have is a thick sample and thin blank. And over here, we've got a thick sample. Okay, now what happens is this guy is back to being sort of thin. I don't want to paste, I just want to copy that image. Ooh, it only grabbed part of it. Cheating. I need the other part. Okay, so there's our blank. And although I think the blank was supposed to be blue. Okay, and our sample winds up having too much water in it. So the amount of water that is in our sample is this big hydroxyl peak. And then we have a very strong CO2 peak and some other small absorbances, such that now when we subtract the blank, what winds up happening is I get a hydroxyl being present after doing the subtraction, and I get a fairly strong CO2 being present after doing the extraction. And so I see the CO2 and I see the water. And the question becomes water or hydroxyl, right? So am I seeing a hydroxyl group or am I seeing water because the blank was too thin? And you can't tell the difference. And so it's really critical that when you make the blank pellet, that the blank pellet and the sample need to be the exact same size in mass, 0.2 grams, such that their path length is the same so that it subtracts evenly. That's the main issue. And the other thing is, where does the CO2 come from? We didn't talk about where the CO2 comes from. Let me grab one of the grinding issues that I did up here. Let's grab this image. Because when you are grinding and observing the mortar and pestle, and you're trying to make sure that you didn't grind it too fine, what happens here is that it's very common to get your face really close to it. And as you get your face really close to the mortar and pestle, you are exhaling. And as you exhale onto it, you're blowing out CO2. And potassium bromide absorbs CO2 fairly dramatically. And so if you are working very close to the mortar and pestle and you're looking at it and you're grinding and you got your face down close to it because you're really trying to see what's going on with the crystals and you're exhaling a lot on it, you're going to increase the CO2. And a couple of different things can happen. Number one, whoever makes the blank is inhaling on the blank a lot while they're making it, then the blank is going to have a lot of CO2. And everybody else that runs after that who's being careful is going to see an inverted upside down CO2 peak. And they're going, well, I didn't inhale on it. I don't know what's going on. Why am I getting an inverted CO2? I made the thing 0.2 grams. It says that the blank was 0.2 grams. I did everything right. It's because whoever made the blank wasn't being careful when they made the blank. The other thing is, whoever made the blank could have been really careful about CO2. And because they were so careful about it, they didn't inhale on it. And you inhaled on yours a lot and you get a great big CO2 peak. The point is, try to keep your face away from the mortar and pestle while you're grinding as much as possible, no matter whether you're making a blank or your pellet, and try to keep CO2 out of the carbon dioxide, just so it doesn't contaminate the spectrum. It doesn't fall in an area where anything else shows up, so it's not really critically important. It's to the left of where the carbonyls show up, but it's nice not to have it in there because it's not supposed to be in there. It's not part of the spectrum. So we can always highlight it and say, yeah, that's CO2, I get it. But it's nice to know where it is. Okay, so we've done all this talk about sample prep, but we haven't looked at the sample yet. So let's analyze quickly, and this doesn't take a whole lot of time, but we can look at the two spectrums for salicylic acid and the spectrums for acetyl salicylic acid, and we can compare them. And before I do that, maybe I should just ask, is there any questions about this whole process of how we go through and make the pellet? I think I've tried to outline it as carefully as I could with all of these sketches and everything. You guys didn't stop me, so I'm going to assume that everything is pretty good. All right, let me go grab some spectra. Let's bring some spectra in and see what we get. So let's do the salicylic acid first. So I don't have those in another place. I'm going to airdrop them into my iPad and drop them into Notability. Okay, so here we have a spectrum of salicylic acid, and the name is up here on the spectrum. This came out of that Japan spectroscopy database, the great database that has so many different compounds in it, and they give you the structure. And while the spectrum is not annotated, they do have all of the wavelengths down here. And so it's fairly easy to correlate a peak with its wavelength down here if you know what it is that you're looking for. So let's kind of see how we do that. And let's take and go through, and we'll draw the compound, and we'll annotate the spectrum and show where the various peaks are that we're interested in. Okay, first off, we are doing this spectrum in a potassium bromide matrix. And I think it says on here KBR disk. So we're in a KBR disk. When you're in a solid matrix like this, there's not very much hydrogen bonding because you're not in solution. And so you get some differences from what you would expect normally for some of the peaks. And for instance, the hydroxyl group that is here, the hydroxyl group, the phenol, and we should highlight the entire phenol here. The phenol shows up here. That this is the phenol peak. And that wavelength is the first wavelength that we see that is 3240. So that's the 3240 wavelength that's there. The rest of this, these guys that are here, are the carboxylic acid and the carbon hydrogen stretches. So the CH stretches are on the edge of that. And then this guy is the carboxylic acid component that is here. And that, let's do that in blue. So that area is all of this part of the spectrum, is where carboxylic acid is showing up. So that's what's there. And I guess I overdid that, because let's do it just this piece here, because what we also want to hit is we want to hit the carbonyl. And we want to distinguish the carbonyl from other things being in this range. So the wavelengths that were these guys, probably those first three wavelengths, are the hydroxyl from the carboxylic acid. And then when we get over to the carbonyl itself, the carbonyl is at 1662. So that's an important wavelength for us because it's the carbonyl wavelength that's there. And then the rest of this is just fingerprint. There are other wavelengths that we could find in there. There are some wavelengths that are in this range that are up here that we haven't really talked about that tell me about the substitution pattern on the aromatic ring system that can tell me whether it is a 1-2, 1-3, or 1-4 substitution pattern. We're not going to go into those necessarily. And there's a lot of other wavelengths in there that we could point to functional groups and talk about, but also not real critical for our analysis of what we need to do today. So that's diagramming this one out. Let's go grab the other one and see how it compares to this one. So we'll grab and airdrop this guy. Okay, so here is what they're calling orthoacetoxybenzoic acid. A little bit about nomenclature. When we have a group, let's do it this way, X and Y. This is called the ortho position. When we have a group that is X and Y, this is the meta position. And a group in the next position is called the para position. So ortho is one, is carbon number two, carbon number three is meta, carbon number four is para. And so we have ortho, meta, and para. And what we do is we abbreviate ortho. Ortho is just abbreviated with the O, and the acetoxybenzoic acid is just a number, another way of naming this compound. So this is orthoacetoxybenzoic acid or acetylsalicylic acid. Let's draw this compound, and then we'll diagram this compound out. Okay, one of the first things that you notice when you look at this spectrum versus the one over here is that this peak is missing. That's the phenol peak. So we look over here, there's no phenol peak. The phenol peak is gone. So where the phenol peak was, let's do it in red because it's missing now. The phenol peak is missing. And that's a good thing because we're hoping that in our transformation, that what we did is we created the ester, and in the creation of the ester, we're hoping that the phenol is gone. And so we have the loss of the phenol is one of the first things that we recognize in this spectrum, that the phenol is missing. The other thing that we recognize is that the carboxylic acid is present, as it should be. So the carboxylic acid, I think I did in blue in the upper spectrum, so we'll do it in blue in here. So this is the carboxylic acid, which has slightly different shape to it, but it's still there. And the carbon hydrogen stretches where they were. The carbonyl, that is the carboxylic acid, is still here, but it's been shifted. So if we look at where that is, that is at 1693. So this first one is at 1693. And if we go back up and we look, we were at 1662. So we went from 1662 to 1693, the carbonyl shifted. So that's another change. And then the ester group is giving us this carbonyl, which is showing up at 1606. No, I'm sorry, 15, 1754. There we go. So this one is at 1754. And that's a second carbonyl that is present that is showing us or indicative of the fact that we have done the transformation that we expected. And there's one more peak that's in here that's around 1190. And 1190 is also the ester, but it's the CO bond of the ester. And so 1190, 10, 1190, that's this bond right here. That 1190 is the CO bond, CO single bond from the ester that is also there. So that's where everything is mapping out. And the blue from the carboxylic acid is showing up all of these guys, is the blue from the carboxylic acid. So we have the loss of the hydroxyl, the gain of a new carbonyl, the shifting of the original carbonyl, and we have the new peak, which is the 1190 peak from the carbon-oxygen single bond of the ester. All of that denotes the transformation and the change to the new product. So we would correlate all three of these types of analysis that we've done, melting point, together with spectroscopy, together with the ferric chloride test. And just as we pointed out those differences between melting point and ferric chloride test, that if we saw impurities in the melting point and we saw impurities in the ferric chloride test, we would expect to see some evidence of those impurities in the IR. For instance, if I had an IR, let's take the original, let's take the product IR. Let's airdrop this in one more time. And let's look at what happens if not pure, if contaminated. With starting material, I'll see an overlay of the two. I would get some amount of phenol, but maybe not a whole lot of phenol. I would get some other peak that came in here that would be another peak at the same wavelength as the original carbonyl. I would see this peak perhaps being shorter and blocked out, so that what I would wind up seeing is the loss. Oh, I need a bigger nib. I would see the loss of this guy and see it shortened down to some extent. And I would see the loss of this guy and see it shortened down to some extent. Because those would be indicating that I didn't have we would have some loss of CO bond, some loss of ester, some gain of original carboxylic acid, and some of the phenol. And it would be increasing amounts of some of those peaks and losses of others that would tell me that I had a mixture of two products that were in the IR. And I would be coordinating that with my melting points and with my ferric chloride test. And then the important part, and I don't know if I said this earlier, but the important part is to then talk about what happened in the reaction that caused those things to happen. So if your reaction was heated too high, if your reaction wasn't heated long enough, if you added water to it, and then let it sit too long before you filtered it such that the reaction went in reverse. If you rinsed it with too much water when it was sitting on the Hirsch funnel and you over-rinsed it, thereby causing the reaction to go in reverse. All of these various things could have contributed to the reaction going in reverse and going back to starting material, or not forming the reaction, like say you forgot the acid catalyst and the reaction ran really slow. And so you didn't get a complete transformation. Whatever it is that you did, hopefully you took enough notes during the reaction to figure out what went wrong. And that's what you write about. Those are the things that I want you to discuss in terms of a formal report, which we're going to go through next time. So next class, we're going to talk a lot about formal reports and what it is that I'm looking for. But ideally, What I'd want you to do is to correlate your results and what happened within the chemical reaction that gave rise to those results, and to learn from them so that we don't repeat them later on. So it's not so much just making sure that you catch everything, but that you're really understanding the chemical reaction through the characterization and understanding what happened in your chemical reaction that gave rise to that product and to that characterization. So I hope that's clear. Okay, that is pretty much everything that I wanted to present. If you guys have any questions or you want to hit me with some questions on any of this, I'm happy to stay and entertain questions. We'll have one more day on this lab where we'll talk about formal reports in this context. So we'll use some of these materials, but it'll be more so just on formal reports itself. And that's where we're at. So how are we doing? Are there any sort of questions that you guys want to do? Or do you feel like I've been talking long enough and there's only so much screen time we can tolerate? And I'm screen timed out by the end of Monday and Wednesday because I feel like I spend all day on the computer. But if you guys don't have any questions, go enjoy the day. I hope you guys stay safe and maybe take a walk and get out so you're not stuck inside all the time, and hang in there.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah.
I have kind of an unrelated question, but I don't know if you got my email about lab, but I'm just curious as to where we're supposed to be in terms of turning stuff in.
Yeah, good question. Okay, I did get that email, and I had not a chance to respond to that yet. So I think I may have done this for the morning class. Maybe I didn't do it for the afternoon, guys. We went through experiments 2, 3, and 4. 2 was solubility. 3 was chromatography. No. Extraction. Extraction was 4. And I think melting points and the mixed melting points were experiment 3. For all of these labs, what was due was the lab notes, copies of the lab notebooks, and then the questions from Pavia. And in the questions, it was both the question section and the report section. And it was basically all of them. And so those should have been turned in already. Then we did lab 5, which was chromatography. And we didn't finish chromatography. So chromatography is when we went in lockdown. And because we never finished that lab, I had nothing due for it. And then we did 6, which was, I'm going to go back and look. And nope. Let's just do a new one here. Let's do Chem Ed. Let's study 12A schedule. All right, it was the crystallization. So we had solubility, crystallization, extraction, chromatography, distillation, and then the infrared. So 6 is distillation, 7 is infrared spectroscopy. Distillation. 7 is infrared spectroscopy. And then 8 is now the synthesis of acetyl salicylic acid. So there was nothing due for chromatography. And while I said mixed melting points up here, this was really crystallization, which included melting points and the mixed melting points. All right, so nothing due here for distillation, nothing due here for IR. Here, what I'm gonna have is I'm gonna have some writing assignments. But we're gonna do that next class. So if you're up to date in terms of sending me, and the solubility and the crystallization should have been turned in before we went on lockdown extraction. People were emailing me the lab notes and finishing out the questions. If you haven't finished out any of those, you can send me any of those and I will take any of them. No penalty, no nothing. Absolutely, I'll take those. No questions asked. They show up, I grade them, you got it. The chromatography, the distillation, the IR spectroscopy, I just couldn't really figure out what it is I wanted you guys to do with those without actually having gone through and done the experiment, which has always been the most valuable component to me. But the writing component, we can do some things here. And so I'll come up with some writing exercises and we'll start with abstracts and we'll work our way into discussion sections and some arguments and how to do some of that writing. And so I think I'll have some assignments that I'll do that'll be some writing assignments for this lab. But we'll give you some time to complete them and after we talk about them next week. Okay, does that help, Mattias?
Yeah, thank you. Would you be able to email me individually to see where I am in the lab itself? Because I don't actually remember if, I remember turning stuff in, but I don't know if it was those exactly.
Okay, yeah, I'll take a look and see what I've got and get back to you.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else
from anybody? Could you do the same for me, please? Because I have no idea what I've turned in either.
Sure, Finn. I'll do the same thing. I'll do the same thing for everybody. I'll start emailing everybody and let you know what I've got and let you know where we're at. I'll just go down the list and
thanks, Jason.
And get everybody. All right.
Thank you, Jason.
Hey, you guys are welcome. Okay, if you're all set, let's call it a day. And we'll see you guys next week. So have a good weekend, okay?
You too.
All right.